Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
It is D-Day. It is the 6th of June. We are celebrating or marking the 80th anniversary since D-Day. So I'm delighted to have my next guest on, because this is Chamber Divers by Rachel Lance. It is the untold story of the D-Day scientists who changed special operations forever. Delighted to say that Rachel joins me live on the line now. Rachel, good morning to you.
Good morning back.
Thanks. Whereabouts are you, by the way, this morning?
I'm actually in London. I came over to mark the anniversary. So tonight I'll be having a beer in the bar, the favorite bar of the scientists in the book.
Right. So for those who don't know, tell me a little bit about what we're talking about here, because we tend to think of D-Day as obviously the parachute troops, the gliders, the people going ashore on the beaches today, 80 years ago. What is your book about the scientists? Well, tell me a little bit about that.
Right. As an American, that's exactly how we're taught D-Day, right? World War II is Pearl Harbor, December 1941, then a miracle occurs, and then we're at June 6, 1944. So I really wanted to focus on what happened in between, because there are years of development there. We have the building of the Mulberry Harbors, the development of the Higgins boats, all these kinds of things. And one of the other things that was going on was this eccentric group of scientists was working on experiments in the middle of London, in the heat of the bombings that were going on there, and they were conducting the science on themselves. Their goal was to figure out what the Allies needed to know in order to send in miniature submarines and divers to the beaches of Normandy for when the D-Day invasion eventually occurred.
And so these were when we're talking mini submarines, how small were we talking here?
Well, first they were powered by a London bus engine, and that kind of gives you the idea for the size scale. But then you've got to fill it with all kinds of equipment. There's breathing tanks with oxygen, carbon dioxide scrubbers, all their espionage equipment for sneaking on shore. They had a little lady's hair dryer to dry off the electronics. So the max outer dimension was about 40 feet long, but once you were inside, it was a lot more compressed than that. And they would shove between 3 and 5 people there. And that was actually how they marked the beaches before the invasion.
This is an incredible thing, isn't it? Because we tend to think D-Day, they just sort of got in boats and charged across. But there were a few more things needed doing before that. One of them was obviously the minesweeping. I've been following on the social medias over the last couple of days. So these incredible stories about them literally going over in mini subs 2 or 3 days before and basically just sort of sitting submerged and popping up to have a look through the periscope and then down again to make sure that the landing craft and knew where to go. It's an amazing story.
Right. It seems passive, but it was this huge sacrifice because they're in this tiny space for 18 and 19 hours a day. They don't have very good breathing gas, so they're actively suffering this entire time. And they know that aiming is going to be incredibly critical for these landings. Because if the troops deviate even slightly, they're under cliffs or they're under German guns. And that's exactly what ended up happening over on Omaha. So you have this huge contrast between the British beaches, where we have the Axcraft personnel standing there with beacons, like flashing green lights or giant flags, waving the people into the exact right spot, versus the beaches at Omaha, where unfortunately they slightly missed. And that led to this huge increase in casualty rate.
So when do they start testing this thing? And what sort of person? I mean, submariners are a breed apart, to put it mildly. But who? And I know a few of them. Trust me on this one.
Yeah.
But who do you, you know, who volunteers to get? What sort of person volunteers to get into an even more cramped sort of submarine?
It seemed like they didn't know what they were signing up for at first, because the submarines were so secret that when the first time their name was sent out via message, people thought it was a mistake. They thought it was essentially a typo. But so these submariners just volunteered for what they knew was extra dangerous duty. But then once they'd been trained, it seemed like they actually argued for who got to do the final duty on the day, because they knew this would be so critical.
Well, whereabouts is today? Because you mentioned that the scientists, this bunch of sort of off the wall scientists, are putting this together in the middle of London. But where do they start sort of building prototypes and testing these things out?
They were originally starting with it down in Portsmouth. So this is, of course, where in the UK you have tons of submarine activity, submarine history, and they still have one of the X-craft down there in a museum, so people can go see it. These X-craft started as the pet project of a couple of naval officers. So just one or two. These naval officers were sort of permitted to do it, but also a little bit brushed off as a, you know, eccentric, oh, this is so-and-so's project on the side. But then once the Allies have this complete debacle of a beach landing in August 1942, they realize that they need completely new ideas in order to make the eventual invasion of mainland Europe work. So 1942 is where you see these submarines go mainstream. All of a sudden, they're moved from this niche project in Portsmouth. They're given this lock to practice in Scotland. So they have this official practice site. The Allies are putting ships up there for them to pretend to target, for the divers to practice getting in and out of the X-craft. You see especially the British, the Royal Navy, start to take these X-craft extremely seriously as a concept. And over those 2 years is when they really start to use them and build up to D-Day, which is eventually what they'll be applied for.
Because this is the thing, isn't it? Because this you talk about the raid in 42, that's Dieppe, isn't it, of course? And this, they try to see if they can take a port, and it goes horribly wrong. And I mean, it's the Canadian losses. I think the Canadians lose 3,000 out of 6,000 men. And that's why they decide that they can't take a port such as Cherbourg, and they have to land on beaches. So they have to work out how they're going to actually orchestrate it.
That's exactly right. At Dieppe, the Canadians had roughly 50% casualties, like you said. At one of the beaches there, they had 95% casualties. Then you compare it to the development that went into D-Day in that intervening 2 years with the X-craft and the divers and the planning, all of a sudden on Sword Beach, the casualties are between 2% and 3%.
Just explain to me then about how they get over there on by their own steam. It's very quiet. It's very secretive. You know, they're not going at a rate of knots, presumably, and they're not going to. Are they going to any great depth? I mean, explain how shallow they are, or how quick these X craft are.
They're not extremely quick, and it was often better for them to be towed. So a lot of the times, a larger surface ship would tow them. They were actually built so small in part so they could be above minefields. So they had a maximum height of 15 feet so that they could go above minefields. So these were not deep water craft. As we've recently learned in modern times, it's harder to build something that goes extremely deep. But building a pressure vessel that goes to the shallows is an easier task. And that was their job. Their job was to get in close to the shore, sink to the bottom in maybe 10, 20 meters, and use it for stealth rather than deep sea exploration.
And so on the run-up to D-Day itself, they sort of pooch lacrosse. Pooch, oh no, that's a technical term, you can tell. They pooch lacrosse, and then presumably their aim is to basically stay there until the landing crew. I mean, A, to wait for the huge bombardment, or is it wait for the minesweepers, or what's their particular role?
Their role is to mark the beaches
for
the first several waves of incoming ships until the beaches are independently set up onshore. So they start out with a green flashing light. Of course, D-Day, the ramp up begins in the middle of the night. There's this full moon lighting the area. They've got this green beacon that shines out to sea, flashing their location. So the two X-craft form kind of the perimeter, the right and left, stay between us. Then as day breaks, they stand on the casing and they replace it with a flag. And of course, this weather is horrific. So they're all getting washed off the tower of the X-craft as they're standing on there. And the only reason that they're saved is because they had to physically tie themselves onto this mini sub. By noon, the beaches are fairly established and there are markings on the beaches. So that's when they can kind of pack it in and get some sleep.
But of course, the other thing is the fact that D-Day is delayed. I mean, but they don't know this, do they? I mean, when they head out, because D-Day is originally a day before, 2 days before. And so therefore, they can't come back. So they've got to sort of basically hang out there, haven't they, for another 48 hours in the bad weather.
Right. It was originally for June 5th, and it got delayed because of the weather. So this team of submariners, they have food and they have supplies. But one of the major problems they're dealing with is the breathing gas. They're underwater for 18 hours during the day because they can't be spotted by the Germans on shore. This would warn the Germans that this invasion is coming and where. And so they have to sink down to the bottom of the ocean and rest on the soil there. So when they get the news that there's an entire extra day, the reports about it are very British. They're very reserved in the amount of complaining that they're doing. But you can kind of see the description of the physiology and how much physical pain they're in because of the carbon dioxide that's building up in their submarine as they're doing this waiting. And they're in this tiny space. They can't really move. There's one spot where you can actually stand up in an X-craft. And there are multiple people in there.
Oh.
Yeah, so they've got to do this for a whole extra day. And hopefully only one. At that point, they don't know if it'll be more than one day.
The other thing is the fact that they're observing, and you've written about this, but I think it's quite illuminating because they can see the German soldiers sort of playing football on the beach, and A, that just shows how close they are and undetected, but B, because they then realise that because they're playing football on that particular stretch of beach, that means there are no mines on that stretch of beach.
That's exactly right. This little football game by the Germans, that's actually intelligence. So they knew that they would have planted mines and ordnance in various places. But of course, the Germans, having done it, are not going to go play football there. So this then becomes intelligence that they can pass back to the landing groups.
How sort of cut off were they? Were they in constant contact with presumably they're being run out of Portsmouth or somewhere like that, the naval command there? And I mean, they would have to surface to or they just put the antenna up through the waves sort of situation to get back in contact with base?
They had an antenna, but they didn't have the ability to transmit. So you have to keep in mind as well, 1944, the technology is we'll call it larger. So if you have a tiny submarine where it's so small, you literally can't stand up. They didn't necessarily have space for the transmission equipment that they would have needed. So to keep in contact, they were listening for secret encoded messages. One of the coastal radio stations off of Portsmouth was receiving messages from the Royal Navy with key words embedded in them. And those were corresponded to code tables that the X-craft crew had. So if they listened to this seemingly innocuous radio broadcast during certain times of the night, they would listen for the code words and that would tell them what was happening with the military action. But they didn't have the ability to communicate back. That actually really impacted their trip over because the trip over was planned assuming the submarines were all going to sink. So they had aircraft flying over. They had monitoring ships. Everyone was very concerned that these key, tiny submarines, hard to find, would sink in the middle of the channel.
And so the invasion begins. There's this there's this huge bombardment. I mean, I'm just thinking what it must have been like to be sort of sitting just beneath the waves or just over the waves as you know, heavy metal comes flying over from this flotilla of ships, and then all these, and then that stops, and then there's, you know, the typhoons are having a quick bash at the rockets as well at the fortifications, and then all these landing craft come steaming past. How do they get out safely, to put it mildly, without getting sort of run over or mistakenly just shot up?
That's the question. So that's the key question of the beach landing. And that's why they had espionage missions ahead of time in order to take samples of the sand, in order to measure the gradients. These operators who went over in the months beforehand were crawling on their bellies and feeling the soil on their face because their hands were numb from the cold. And they were providing this information back so that the Allies could practice on matching beaches in the UK. And that's what ended up happening. A lot of the soldiers who were running on shore said it felt very similar. They not only put this innovation into the building of X-Craft, but they put it into creating this series of equipment called Hobart's Funnies. So among other things, they had these flail tanks with big chains searching for mines. They had these comical-looking BB tanks, which were nicknamed Donald Ducks, because they were waterproof, they could swim and then drive up shore. And then, of course, this is all a big part of this key transition of getting people on to land from the water.
It's fascinating that you think about the level of preparation, because, again, we just think, okay, they, as you said before, that sort of Pearl Harbor to D-Day, and we just think they said, oh, okay, let's go. But actually sending people over, I mean, highly difficult and dangerous to check out the sand so that they know what sort of sand to expect when they arrive. So they're not going, oh, it's shingle here.
Exactly. They had soil experts analyzing these samples back in England. They even recruited a famous beach race car driver was famous for driving on the beach, and he was the Royal Navy consultant for vehicles holding on the sand pipes. So they put a ton of work into this, and a lot of that traces back to Dieppe. Dieppe was this horrible failed experiment where they had been willing to throw thousands of lives at the problem. And they said, let's try what happens if we try this by just inundating the shores with disposable lives to them. And it still didn't work. No matter how many people they were willing to throw at it, they still couldn't take the town. They couldn't take the beach. So that was when they realized that that tactic wasn't going to work. They had to instead innovate. That's what I personally, as a biased engineer, that's what I think is beautiful about D-Day, is the amount of preparation that went in, and all of that preparation saved lives.
And also, of course, you know, being an engineer, what you're going to love more than anything else is the, I know it's a little off thing, but the Mulberry, because we can't build a port because the Germans will wreck every port they're going to have, like Cherbourg, like Dieppe. So we're just going to build one the size of Dover and tow it over, i.e. Oh, the Mulberry. I mean, it's ridiculous, isn't it?
Naturally. Yeah. The ideas to me that got used at D-Day for the first time are so fascinating, because it looks like you just had a group of engineers in a room who, likely in Norfolk House in London, right? Who just were allowed to run wild. And then they were given the money to build these things and try it. And some of these worked fantastically, like the Mulberry, like you said. Like, that was such an amazing innovation.
So how did you come across this story of the experts? Because, again, I hadn't really heard of it. And as I say to people off air normally, I'm that worst sort of creature, the armchair historian. So how did you find this particular? And it is a brilliant story. And you're just thinking, I mean, the service and the bravery for guys to say, okay, I'm gonna sit in this little space under the water for literally 24, and if you get captured, you're gonna get shot because you're gonna be a spy. It's gonna be espionage. So it's just the bravery is just off the scale.
The X-Craft have been fairly known, but not the extent to which they contributed. And what's never been talked about before is the development behind those and the divers, like these scientists who are doing these experiments on themselves to make those innovations happen. So that's the first half of the book, and then the military action is the second half. I found it because essentially it was like a scab I couldn't stop picking at. I had this paper from 1941, this academic, incredibly boring paper. A group of super nerds were testing carbon dioxide on themselves in London. And I couldn't figure out why they cared about carbon dioxide in the middle of the woods. So I kept searching. And a lot of these documents that link those stories actually have, they were recently declassified. So this story has never been told before. You're not alone.
That's the thing. And people will say to me, why do you study history so much? Because it's done, it's dusted, it's boring, it's done. Oh no, it's not. Because as these documents come out, as these documents are declassified, there are more and more of these amazing sort of you couldn't make it up stories coming to light. And also, I mean, it's very, very sad because we're seeing these pictures today, and this will be the last time that you would be 98, 99. Yeah. So it's the last time we see these. So a lot of this generation are passing away. But on the flip side, I suppose you say, is these, as I was speaking to Damien Lewis, they're saying, go to your attics and find stuff because there are diaries and first-hand accounts that are coming to light as the last of the generation pass away that shed an absolutely blinding spotlight on some of the stuff that people got up to.
I absolutely couldn't agree more. And then sometimes the documents aren't even public until after everyone's died. So that's what happened with this story. A lot of the scientists that were kind of the link between the development and the execution had passed away by the time everything was declassified. They never got to tell their own story. So I'm trying to do it for them.
So when you come to write something like this, how difficult is it not to go sort of supernova nerd on it and go, well, I found this and it's, you know, and put it in a sort of a constructive and a coherent narrative?
It's very difficult. My test subject is my mother because she's incredibly smart. She's a very intelligent lady. She's a heavy reader, loves to read, and she has zero science background. She has no information about science. So if my mother can read it and finds it interesting and then can explain it back to me, I know I've written it correctly.
Wonderful. What are you hoping that people will take from Chamber Divers? What do you think they're going to learn?
I'd like them to learn just how much humanity there is behind these stories. The big part of this book that I really wanted to bring was the fact that these are individual people who are making these choices during a time of hardship for everyone. They had the choice to evacuate. Like this group and the X-Craft submariners had the choice to not volunteer for this duty. So these are individual people with lives that they were willing to put on the line in order to do something we saw as necessary and good. And I think that's something that we really need to keep in mind as we discuss these stories like the D-Day anniversary. These were people.
Yeah, and in a really strange way, I thought it just struck me, actually, as I was just going through this interview, because today we're marking the 80th anniversary, and my grandfather was on the beaches as a Royal Engineer. He ended up being a regimental sergeant major. He'd been in Italy. Wow. He ended up in Germany and Cyprus. And the thought just struck me because he was on, and I'm trying to find out, I don't know if it was Sword or Juno, it would be one of the British beaches. And he talks about trying to put a bridge up under fire and that sort of thing. But if it hadn't been for the work that the X-boats did, he might not have made it in the way that because there were no X-boats for the Americans at Omaha, they drifted underneath that position. And if you see Save Private Ryan, you know what happens next. But my grandfather and many other people survived. And if he hadn't, then I would be here and we wouldn't be having this interview, which is a bit of a mind blow. But I was just halfway through, I just suddenly thought, hang on a second. So there's a link, isn't there? I mean, we're all interconnected with this.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially the Royal Engineers were some of the ones that benefited from this because in Dieppe, they were all killed quite quickly, especially putting up bridges, things like that. Those were areas where some of this engineering innovation was taking place because the goal was to do that quickly. Get everyone off the beaches. Beaches are unprotected. You can get shot at there. So that entirely possible. Thankfully, it didn't happen.
No, exactly. Otherwise, it would have been a very short interview indeed. The book is called Chamber Divers. It's by Rachel Lance. Rachel, if people want to find you online, I know you are because I'm stalking you on the internet. So where can people find you in the nicest possible way?
Oh, thank you. I'm very easy to Google now. I have a website, Rachel Lance Writes, that has information about my books and contact form. And then I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Underwater Lance, where I tweet about nerd stuff.
Underwater Lance. You'll be able to order the book as well via our own virtual bookstore. The book is called Chainable Divers. It's by Rachel Lance. Rachel, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me today.
Thank you for having me.